Hello and welcome to as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 10th of January 2016. My name's D.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Nick from Past Two Obstructed View, Gareth James, Julie Raby, Johnny Fox, and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about The Dazzle, which is a play by Richard Greenberg at the Found 111 space in the Charing Cross Road. This is the former home of the Central St Martin's College. The play is very loosely based on the lives of a couple of eccentric brothers called the Collier brothers, who lived in a home in Harlem, and as the 20th century changed around them, they became more and more reclusive and started hoarding vast amounts of stuff, books and other knickknacks. In this play, the brothers are played by Andrew Scott and David Dawson, and we occasionally get a female visitor to balance them out, played by Joanna Vanderham. Nick, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, it's interesting that we're doing this in the same week as Grey Gardens, because they're both, although obviously this isn't a musical, they're both based on true stories of sort of American royalty, which generally translates as very rich people, who ended up living in absolute squalor. In the case of The Dazzle, they also ended up dying in not necessarily mysterious circumstances, because the way they lived kind of explains how they ended up getting crushed by their own possessions, I think, is how at least one of them died, and the other one probably died of starvation, I think. But it's a very odd story, so you can understand how both of these have sort of appealed to playwrights to bring to the stage. So as you say, I mean, the story is largely imagined, because what we do know is basically that these very wealthy pair of brothers became reclusive, became hoarders, and were eventually found dead. So the story of their lives and how they got there is something that Greenberg's had to really make up. And what he's gone for as kind of an explanation, in a way, is of Langley, who's the one played by Andrew Scott, and is kind of the moneymaker of the two, because he's a celebrated concert pianist, or at least he is at the start. But what we see is that he's kind of got almost a condition, really, where he's hyper aware of everything, and he kind of can't forget anything that he's ever seen or heard. And essentially, the idea is that this is slowly driving him completely insane. He can't dismiss any detail from his life, and you often have this thing where he hears a piece of music, and if it's tiniest bit out of tune, it's like water torture to him. And that's kind of what the dazzle of the title is, that every tiny little detail is amplified in his life, and he can spend a day studying a single pine needle. So that's kind of the explanation that Greenberg's come up with, that he's gradually going more and more insane, and his brother Homer, who's the David Dawson character, has basically given up everything else in his life to look after him. Theoretically, he's now acting as his accountant, but in practice, he's basically his carer. That's sort of the dynamic that we're presented with. And in the first act, it's dysfunctional, but they're just about getting along with their lives. By the second act, all the characters, including the Joanna Vanderham character, have deteriorated to a huge amount. From what I looked up, I don't think Joanna Vanderham's character is based on a single person. I think she's possibly a combination of different people. She's called Millie Ashmore, which I think was a real person, but I don't think her life was quite the one we see in this. So I think actually the character we see is a mix of different real-life people and a bit of imagination as well. It's quite interesting, I think. I mean, it's been quite a divisive piece, it seems. A lot of people have really, really hated it. But I didn't absolutely love it, but I thought it was quite interesting. And obviously very strong performances. Both Andrew Scott and David Dawson were kind of, I mean, Andrew Scott's been quite a name for a few years now, but David Dawson has, I think, been doing more stuff on TV, so he's become a bit of a draw as well. And they're both very reliable. I think Joanna Van Hem was a good Desdemona at the LSE last year, and she kind of gives as good as she gets in kind of the smaller role of Burke, quite a critical role, because she's got quite an effect on what happens, and things kind of come to a head because she's there in some ways, definitely in the first act. And both acts in different ways are the story of how she kind of comes into this weird little bubble of the two brothers for a while, and how that pushes things to not stay quite as they are, and usually for the worse, as it turns out. So yeah, it's an interesting piece. I mean, it's sold out in its entire run now, and I think it's got a very limited amount of day tickets on sale, which apparently go very quickly, but I'm not convinced about the venue. I can see exactly why people would have thought it was an appropriate venue, because it's up a lot of stairs. It's kind of a bit of a journey to get there. Not just up a lot of stairs, but you're going lots of different staircases and through different levels. And so you basically get to this incredibly cluttered set and feel like you kind of understand what sort of house you're meant to be in. But to be honest, I think that we didn't need quite that amount of immersive to understand the point, and I think for people a bit older or disabled, it will be an absolute nightmare to try and get anywhere there. It's not a particularly comfortable venue. They've got these very, very small chairs tightly packed together, but the show is interesting. Gareth, what do you think?
I really didn't like the play. I won't say I hate it, but I really didn't like the play. The problems with it for me, first of all, I just couldn't believe in the character of Millie, and I couldn't understand why she would enter these lives, why she would stay there, and how it would unfold for her in the way it does. So I just, as much as I enjoyed Joanna Vanderholm's acting, I just didn't believe in the character at all. The two brothers are more believable, but I didn't like them. And it didn't go anywhere for me, really. I did understand it was based on a true story. I didn't understand until you mentioned it, Nick, that the character of Millie actually wasn't a real character. I kind of assumed that she was a real character.
Don't entirely take my word for that. I was just kind of looking up some stuff about it afterwards, and I could find a character by that name, but she didn't seem to conform to what happened in the play, so I assumed she was a bit more of a construction, but don't take my word for that as being absolutely true. She could be real for all I know.
In a way, though, my not believing in the character kind of stacks up against the possibility that she wasn't a real whole character. So you know, it could be or it couldn't be. But in any whichever way you look at it, I just didn't buy her, really. There was an implausibility about it, and I didn't like the characters, and therefore the play just didn't go anywhere for me. And in particular in the second half, I think it just got so, so, so dark. And so, so, so tragic. I just kind of left the theatre deeply depressed, really. So not an enjoyable play for me. And I do wonder why we haven't seen more of Richard Greenberg's plays, because when sort of doing a little bit of looking around, I mean, he appears to have written 24 original plays. I'm taking out the adaptations. And I think this is only the third we've seen in London. So I do wonder, is Richard Greenberg a playwright that doesn't cross the Atlantic? I also took against the venue, because the venue wasn't appropriate for the play for me. I didn't see the point of putting it here, and I saw lots of reasons why you shouldn't put it here, really. I mean, the only other production of this venue was Barbarians, where the venue made a lot of sense. I mean, the material connected with the space. They used different parts of the buildings for the three little plays that comprises Barbarians. And I thought they created a fairly unique atmosphere. And it made sense for me seeing Barbarians there, you know, an awful lot of sense. But then I thought, well, what's this doing here, really? You know, it's using a very small amount of the space. As you say, is very cramped and very uncomfortable. And that might make sense in terms of the sort of claustrophobia in the way they lived, but not enough to warrant putting it here for me. I thought, well, you know, why isn't it in an off-Western theatre like Southwark Playhouse or somewhere like that? Because it would work perfectly well and probably better. You'd get less. You'd have better sight lines, because a lot of people on the sides and on the second row, which isn't raked, had very bad sight lines. And there's actually quite a bit of traffic noise, because this part of the space is directly onto Charing Cross Road, and I was at the back row, so there was quite a bit of traffic noise, I thought, as well. So I took against the venue, and I took against the play, I'm afraid. And having said all of that, there is no question that these are three great performances, but they're three great performances that, for me, weren't fully utilised, given the material and given the space in which they were asked to play it. So I found it very disappointing. And I honestly, even though you probably couldn't get in, I honestly couldn't recommend it, I don't think.
I don't have too much to add. I will say that I'm fairly sure on the programme there was an author's note where Richard Greenberg said he knew nothing about the Collier brothers. So he's basically just taken the names and the situation and has played with it. So I think that the woman is entirely fictional in that sense, although he may have taken a name from their biography. But he didn't want to make it too close. He wanted to make it his own construction. Yeah, I agree with Gareth that he's not been terribly successful over here. I mean, 3 Days of Rain is his biggest play, and that's had a couple of decent runs on it. It was done at the Donmar and also done in the West End a few years ago. Another play of his which did rather well over in the States and was done by the Donmar as well was Take Me Out, which is all about a gay man trying to come out in baseball. I think the most recent play of his that was over here was The American Plan, which was done at the Theatre Old Bath and came in for a short time at St James's Theatre a couple of years ago. But yeah, he's not made a big splash over here, but he does seem to be an interesting playwright. I was okay with this play, but I was, as with everyone else, I was very impressed by the performances. I mean, we are gradually losing Andrew Scott to other things. And David Dawson, an actor I've known about for quite some time, he was in an exceptionally good production of The Comedians a few years ago, where he played an extremely manic Welsh comedian whose act was completely bizarre when people wanted the standard. The Comedians is about a group of trainee comedians and they all have to do their acts, and it's in the 70s. So what people wanted was the 70s acting and not the bizarre comedy that The Comedians wanted. And David Dawson was amazing in that particular play and that particular role. So that's the first time he ever jumped in on me. So he's always worth watching, and he's definitely, I think, definitely worth watching it here. But I think the play is a little bit of a disappointment. So, Julie, what do you think about The Dazzle?
Well, I disagree a little bit with some of the things that you were saying, because I actually really like the play itself, and I quite like the location. For me, there was something about discovery going up all those stairs, even though it's slightly exhausting, with the lift shaft, not knowing what you were going to find at the top. I'd been forewarned that the second row wasn't raked and there were bad views from there, so I was told don't sit anywhere like that, sit further back, and my sight lines were absolutely fine, so I was actually sat on the back row, but I felt really close to the action. I thought there was two outstanding performances from Andrew Scott and David Dawson, and I really did like Joanna Vanderham's performance in this, because I've been very disappointed with the kind of overacted performances, Desdemona in the Othello at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford, and I just felt that she really didn't have the experience to carry that role off. So I was quite pleasantly pleased to see a good performance in Dazzle. I really like David Dawson, having seen him in Posh and recently as Ferdinand in The Duchess of Malfi. And he's kind of an actor that can just take a role a little bit further. I just thought it was quite a moving play for me about love. And there was that line that David Dawson had about familial love and kind of trying to express how important it was. And even the frustration of living with a brother on the autistic spectrum, there was a clear sense of them being really, really loving each other. And Andrew Scott said at one point, Lang, I really love our life. And you could see the other brother thinking, oh no, you know, I've given everything up for this. But Andrew Scott having this kind of joy of the life they'd got. And I think that's why I really like the venue, because I felt it was kind of trapped and enclosed, and these two men were trapped and enclosed in this space, and they become even more trapped and enclosed as the years had gone on. And I think that, for me, that kind of concrete space gave that impression, and I really like that. I think there was a few kind of cliches a little bit, because often you read about people on the autistic spectrum, one of the ways of describing it is that they focus on the real detail of things. So there's the same, you can't see the wood for the trees, but with people on the autistic spectrum, I've heard it said things like, well, they'll focus on the leaves. So we have that theme running through, that sense that the Ylang focused on the leaves constantly, the detail of the leaves, that kind of obsession with that. And I thought maybe that was just kind of taking it a little bit too far. So for me, I really, really enjoyed the whole thing. I really loved Andrew Scott's performance, but I thought David Dawson was outstanding.
Just a quick note. We recorded this before the unfortunate death of Alan Rickman. We're now going to talk about Les Liaisons Dangereuses at the Donmar Warehouse. This is Christopher Hampson's play. It hasn't been performed much since it was first done in the late 80s, and it was on for a very long time after the RSC did it with a classic production, which included Lindsay Duncan and Alan Rickman. And I think the first time people really got to know who Alan Rickman was, certainly I got to know who Alan Rickman was through that play, although I didn't see it at the time. There was a production of this play about 12 years ago with the likes of Amelia Fox, Jared Harris and Polly Walker in it, but I don't think that that did quite as well. This production has quite a cast to it. It stars Janet McTeer and Dominic West as the Vicomte de Valmont and Marquise de Merteuil. And they're also joined by the likes of Una Stubbs and Gerard Ho, Morpheus Clark and Elaine Cassidy. Elaine Cassidy taking over from Michelle Dockery at I think before they actually started rehearsing, but it was initially announced with Michelle Dockery in the part of the virtuous Madame de Tavel. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
When it was announced they're going to do a Donmar, I was really pleased because I didn't recall a production of this play since the original production. The one that you mentioned just wasn't on my radar at all. So I thought it was great that we were getting a revival of this at long last. But I was also a little bit nervous because having seen the original production, which was in the Barbican's Pit, you know, in addition to Alan Rickman and Leslie Duncan, you mentioned, I mean, the other actors included Juliet Stevenson and a very young Leslie Manville as the young girl in the play. Which is just, you know, if you look at just those four names, you think, oh my God, is it possible to follow that? So there was a little bit of trepidation, really. You know, are they going to sort of pull this off? Although 30 years is a long time. Well, they have pulled it off. Frankly, I'd kind of forgotten how good the play was, really. And this revival is a sort of brilliant reminder that it probably is Christopher Hampton's masterpiece. It's, of course, based on a late 18th century novel, a French novel by Lacoste, which by the standards of 1985 was pretty racy and still feels pretty racy now, really. So goodness knows what it was like in the 18th century or what they felt about it in the 18th century, certainly in a pruder Britain. It's a very steamy tale of sexual intrigue and manipulation. The novel was written as a series of letters, but of course Christopher Hampton's adaptation takes a more traditional dramatic form. And I think it's beautifully structured, and I think the dialogue is just terrific, really. And it centres around these very Machiavellian games that are played by two friends and I think former lovers, the Vicomte de Valmont, who's played by Dominic West, and the Marquis de Merteuil, who's played by Janet McTeer, who I think is a very underrated actress. I really have, you know, liked Janet McTeer for years, really. And they are both terrific, and they're great together. The sort of the spark between them is absolutely terrific. And they're kind of playing these Machiavellian games on a young lady called Cécile Volange and a Chevalier Danceny, who's in love with her, and then also with Madame de Tourville, who's a seemingly inaccessible guest of Le Vicomte's aunt, where some of the play is set. And the stakes of these games turn out to be a lot higher than either of them imagined when they start playing these games, and it does come to a very tragic conclusion. It really suits the Donmar space because it gives it a great intimacy. Tom Scott has designed a kind of faded or fading stately home design, which I think really suits the piece and suits the venue, and a lot of candlelight, which also I think makes it look particularly gorgeous. The performances are fantastic, not just Dominic West and Janet McTeer, but I thought Elaine Cassidy was superb, and I thought Morpheus Clark was also superb in the role of the young girl. But there are also some really nice smaller parts. Edward Holcroft, who plays Danceny, impressed me recently on TV in a three-part, I think it was, called London Spy with Ben Whishaw, and I think he's impressed me here as well. I thought, you know, he made a big impression here, as he did on television. And there's just lovely cameos. You know, Eunice Stubbs is lovely as Darmon's aunt. And then there's an actor called Theo Barklund-Biggs, who's the servant to Dominic West's character. And the final thing I'd say about it is that the scene changes are actually delightful because they're musical scene changes. And there's a singer-stroke-actress called Alison Arnop, who plays a servant Julia, who kind of sings through these scene changes, and I thought that was just wonderful, really. So I just thought it was a very, very fine revival. You know, the 30 years is such a long time, given that we seem to see things in 18, 19-year cycles lately, and I mean, surely this is going to transfer, one would hope, so more people can see it. I think it's particularly brilliant in the Donmar, but I think it would work in a bigger theatre as well, and I think it's long overdue, and for me, a brilliant reminder of what a good play it is. So, Nick, what did you think?
When did you see it, Gareth?
I saw it on the 29th of December. I saw it between Christmas and New Year.
Right, okay. It's just because you didn't mention the thing that maybe didn't happen when you went to see it that everybody else mentions about it, which was Dominic West not knowing his lines.
We were perfect the night I went.
Yeah. No, I mean, the night I went to see it, several fluffs throughout the lines, stumbling on quite a lot of lines, and my friend and I thought, God, he's really having a bad night. And then I looked online and there was people from, you know, whenever they went, people just going, he didn't know his lines. Or, you know, he knew most of them, but he was really clearly not confident in them and, you know, stumbling over quite a lot of them. So I think that's possibly really the only reason I could be less enthusiastic about him, to be honest. And also, really, it was the only thing that sometimes, because it sort of slowed down the production a bit, it sort of showed you that the production was really coasting on its pace. But when that pace does work, I think it is excellent. And yes, I mean, to me, it is absolutely carried by Janet McTeer. And she's just so watchable and so kind of gleefully sort of wicked in the part. And I think it's an interesting process seeing these two characters who kind of define themselves to each other, at least. There's so many kind of different levels of deceit, particularly with her, because he's, and it is kind of a gender thing, being a man, he can be known as a bit of a cad and kind of scandalous, and it doesn't kind of make him a social pariah. He can kind of be invited to things and it's all a bit shocking and, oh my God, we've invited him. But with her, because she's a woman, she couldn't get away with that, so she's actually got an incredibly respectable reputation, and underneath it all, she's scheming against everybody and is, you know, sleeping around and having a whale of a time. But then also, what's quite interesting to watch in the play is her, and to a lesser extent, Valmont, sort of seeing how dependent on each other they actually are, because they're all about the games and they're all about the sexual intrigue, and they like to kind of think that that is literally all there is to them. There's no kind of vulnerability or real emotion in there, but as they kind of find, especially as she sees that he's actually falling for somebody else, she shows her vulnerability there. So I thought, yeah, she's absolutely the reason to go see this, although there is, as you say, a very strong supporting cast, a lot of very good performances in there. And I really loved Tom Scutt's design. This is, well, it was written and so obviously set just before the French Revolution. And I think that the set is in the present day, with these characters kind of coming on as ghosts and moving aside the plastic dust sheets from the opening. It's very clear this is not something that's going to last. And it is kind of the last hurrah, really, although they don't realise it, of people who can live their lives this way and just manipulate each other because they've got all the money and all the privilege. So yeah, I think it's a very interesting production. I think it does, I suppose, depending on when you go see it and how, presumably by now, it's kind of been sorted out, and maybe over Christmas Dominic West sat down and just made sure he got his lines into his head. But I think certainly for people who saw it earlier, that's going to be one particularly memorable thing about it, which is unusual because, you know, I mean, I've seen him on stage before in large roles. I mean, you know, he had a lot to learn in The River, and, you know, he never seemed to have a problem with that. So it is quite a surprising thing to see him fluffing up his lines so badly, and apparently for quite a lot of performances. But yeah, it's generally a very good production.
Yeah, he did make a few mistakes on the night I went. I mean, well, it didn't feel too much like mistakes. It felt as if he knew the lines, he just didn't want to say those particular lines. He wanted to twist them slightly, perhaps almost a film thing, because you do hear a lot of the idea in film and to a certain extent in American TV, where you don't have to say exactly the words that are put down on the script. You have to say what the words mean or what the words feel. And I got the impression that maybe he was in that kind of mindset when he was watching it. I mean, he was still very watchable. But for me, this is Janek Mateer really delivering a great role in this play. I remember the first time she really jumped out at me. I mean, I'd heard of her as an actress. But she did, over a decade ago, again, a version of The Doll's House, where she played Nora, of course. And for me, she was the definitive Nora, although we've had some pretty good versions of The Doll's House since then. They really never bettered Janek Mateer. She was incredible in that, and I thought she was extremely good in this. One of the other thoughts I had when I saw it, and the reason I mentioned Michelle Dockery at the start, was that I couldn't actually imagine Michelle Dockery doing Madame Tavel. And you can easily imagine Elaine Cassidy doing it, that kind of breakdown that she has. And it would have been very interesting to see Michelle Dockery doing it, and it's a kind of pity that she didn't, because she wouldn't have been as easy as it appears to have been for Elaine Cassidy to do it. And Elaine Cassidy is extremely good. Yeah, I was very happy with this production. I'm not a big Christopher Hampton fan. In fact, I came quite to loathe him early on in my theatre-going habit. But certainly this play is very good, and I'd like to see more things for Janek Mateer to do, because she is, as I say, extremely watchable. So, Julie, what did you think about Les Liaisons Dangereuses?
Well, I agree with you. It was a very exceptional production. And I thought, for me, because I saw it just after New Year, what a treat to start the year off with something like this. I was absolutely bowled over by Janek Mateer's performance, as you were. And I do agree that we don't see her that much on stage, as much as we really should. But the real sense of this woman inventing herself, they use that phrase, how do you invent yourself? And that kind of way that she was able to convey that exterior elegance and grace, but we were kind of privy as an audience to her thinking and the way of doing the things and her manipulation. And really this society where they hadn't got anything to do really but play these kind of sex games and these kind of manipulation with people, a society, because obviously the novel was written just before the French Revolution, wasn't it? It that sense of this kind of world that was going to fracture and fall apart. I love the novel itself. I've really loved the novel, and it is a series of letters, the novel. And I think when you put it on stage, there was that kind of reference to don't put anything in writing. And I think there's a little irony there that obviously the letters in the stage play become absolutely crucial as a way of people being unmasked and things like that. I think the ending in the novel as well is that Madame Mateer, she gets smallpox, doesn't she? And she becomes really disfigured. And you don't get a real sense in the play of her being punished. But there is a kind of problem for me with that. It's the women that are absolutely punished and the men get away with it. I thought Dominic West's performance was a fine performance. I think, I hate to say this, but there were times when I didn't really think he was attractive enough in that role to actually make me believe that he was such a seducer. Sometimes I didn't always find that as convincing as it could be. I thought Elaine Cassidy's performance was great as well, and I did feel that she carried it off. But again, I just couldn't take my eyes off Janek Mateer. The way she wore the dress, the absolute way that she projected this beauty, I just thought it was stunning. And for the whole nearly 3 hours, I was just so entertained by the whole thing. And the night before, I'd seen Waste at the National, which has a similar theme of a society underneath is all corrupt. And, you know, that all this kind of gentility is covering up this kind of corrupt world. And I must admit, I thought the Les Liaisons Dangereuses was much better at conveying that. So I think for me, it's been a great start to 2016 with Dazzle I enjoyed, and the Leclos as well.
We're now going to talk about Grey Gardens, which is a musical with a book by Doug Wright, music by Scott Frankel, and lyrics by Michael Corey. It's been done at the Southwark Playhouse and concerns, well, two Kennedy aunts. Well, actually, they're the aunt and cousin of Jacqueline Bouvier, Jackie Kennedy. And they were the subjects of a documentary in the 1970s and became rather famous for their decrepit lifestyles, rather reminiscent of Dazzle, so we do have a bit of a theme this week, I think. It's directed by Tom Sutherland, so we are hoping great things from it. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I can hardly think of a show that has been so greatly anticipated or suddenly become such a hot ticket and a sellout. The pre-publicity for Grey Gardens was a ferment of eager excitement that this piece was going to be played here. It had a life on off-Broadway and then with revision on Broadway. But it is, you know, like so many things, it's a very American story, and you wondered whether it would play quite so well over here, because as you said, Tim, it's a narrative about the aunt and cousin of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, but two women who were pretty minor celebrities even in the Kennedy family, and since the Kennedy family sort of withdrew the funding for the house that they lived in East Hampton on Long Island, they just lived a life of recluses and somewhat unsavory and decrepits, really. And they are known in the story and in real life as Old Edie and Young Edie, or Big Edie and Little Edie, something like that. But Edie Bouvier Beale and Little Edie Beale. So if this weren't a musical, you might not really have heard of them, because I don't think the documentary in 1973 was very much aired, although I think Paul knows more about it than I do. I've only seen a small clip from it. And it must be, I think, also the first musical to be based on a documentary. I think lots of derivatives of book come from other sources, but I can't think of another one that came directly from a documentary. But it has become a huge hit, an instant raft of rave reviews, and only a couple of small dissents from thinking people like, let's say, Michael Billington, who only gave it 3 stars, but all the bloggers and most of the broadsheets gave it 4 or 5, and it has really sold out in a flash. Does it deserve to have done so? Well, it, certainly from curiosity value, and certainly from the value to be found in the second half of the musical. In the second half of the musical, you see these two women, batty as anything, living out a kind of whatever happened to Baby Jane life, making each other meals, filling the house with cats and raccoons, and generally living in perfect squalor, and being completely bonkers, the pair of them. And there is a performance that really is magnificent in the degree of grotesque, but also in the musical and comic perfection that Jenna Russell brings to the role of the younger Edie, particularly as an adult. And it's got to be one of the funniest things you will see on stage this year. She is just a fabulous caricature, but also, if you have seen a little bit of the documentary, fabulously accurate. I mean, she's not sending this up or making it more grotesque than it needs to be. She is giving a pretty accurate portrayal of how completely loopy and off the rails this woman was. What the team who behind the musical have also done then, in order to flesh it out a bit, is giving you a prequel, an imagined prequel, set in 1941, I think, when young Edie is briefly betrothed to another scion of the Kennedy family, Joseph, who was JFK's elder brother, who was a Navy pilot and shortly after killed in action. They pitch it round an engagement party for Joseph and Edie, to which Joseph doesn't turn up, or rather, at which Joseph jilts her and decides that she is not suitable material to be his bride. Although, of course, she would have ended up as his widow fairly soon after. But this then is sort of the middle and both ends of the plot, because it casts a very, very long shadow over the lives of the two women, who then become lacking in funding, lacking in self-confidence, lacking in any kind of purpose in their lives. And what then happens, the subsequent decay, is beautifully illustrated in this piece, but I'm not sure it's beautifully explained, because it's very hard to understand why two obviously intelligent and resourceful and bright women would find it absolutely impossible to pick up a dishcloth or paint a wall for 30 years, and why they chose to live in this sort of Steptoe and Son squalor for the rest of their natural lives, certainly for the rest of Mrs. Beale's natural life. What are the performances like? They are terrific, mostly. I mean, Jenna Russell, absolutely, this is her show, because she is the older Edie in the first half and the younger Edie in the second half. So she carries the mass of the musical load and does it absolutely brilliantly. There are some storming numbers. I mean, none better than the one where she describes her own rather bizarre costume, which generally tends to be a cardigan where she's stuck her head through the armhole or knotted it tightly around her face. In fact, she looks, most of the second half, she looks a little bit like Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein, just sort of staring out of this cowled head. And a lot of the songs are pastiches of the cabaret work she would have liked to have done had she become a musical star, which she wanted to and didn't. And then there are others which are a little bit more humdrum. And then there's this beautiful, torchy, plaintive song that is the 11 o'clock number called Another Winter in a Summer Town, which is just a dream, really, and she carries it off magnificently. I want to praise some of the other people in the cast, particularly Rachel Ann Raham, the young actress, young diminutive actress who plays little Edie Beale. This is a debut for her, and it's a magnificent one. She really is a terrific performer, and I hope we see a great deal more of her. And I also like the work of Jeremy Liggett as a man called George, who is Edie's sort of companion, really. I think he seems to be in the household as a sort of paid companion. He plays the piano when she sings, he dances attendance on her. There is a suggestion that he may or may not be stopping her in return for some nice cufflinks. And then there is Sheila Hancock. She doesn't have very much to do in the first half, but in the second, she is this withered grand dame, where she croons her songs really beautifully. She has the most acidly accurate comic timing, dropping these poisonous little remarks into the conversation and skewering everybody with not just a glance, but with some wonderful words. So there's a great deal to enjoy in it. I do think the first half is overlong and feels flat compared to what happens in the second, but that's possibly because it's more imagined by the creative team than the second half, which is taken pretty directly from the life and documentary of the life of the Beale mother and daughter. Paul, tell us some more, particularly about the historical bit that you know more of.
Well, yes, I think it would be fair to say that the documentary itself, Grey Gardens, is probably not as well known here in the UK as it is in the United States or perhaps elsewhere. I think I only became familiar with it once I heard about the off-Broadway show itself. And actually, if you'd seen the documentary, you would know that the second half mirrors the documentary so closely that most of the dialogue and the source of many of the songs is just lifted directly from it, which is quite an achievement in itself. I think some people have described this show, though, as high society, being the first half, which has high society style music. It's very Cole Porter, or it's sort of like a pastiche of music from that period, meeting Whatever Happens to Baby Jane. But actually, thinking about this musical, particularly in the days since seeing it, and also I had seen the musical Kinky Boots the night before, I actually felt this show completely avoids any of that campiness and goes much more for, you know, trying to get that emotional connection about trying to actually explore this mother-daughter relationship a lot more than it's being given credit for, particularly from some of the critics that have actually given it less than favorable reviews. I think it's actually, you know, quite a clever attempt from the creators of this show to actually try and produce a musical that doesn't have much of a plot and try and actually explore the relationships a lot more. Because the first half is quite a fictional account of what actually happened, but it was trying to explain how things got to where they were, sort of the wrong turns taken. I still think, and I agree, that it's probably a little bit too long to actually make this point and then move into the second half, particularly because the second half is so different, but it's also so much funnier, and the music is much more memorable, and it's much more original, and I think it really just takes off into another level. I think Jenna Russell has definitely been given a star performance, also a performance to show off
you know, she's an incredibly funny woman anyway, but with this material, it just takes it to a new level. I think there's a memorable scene when she feeds the cats and she gets out a box of cat food and half a bag of sliced bread and just dumps it in front of the feet of the audience in the front row. And it's just hysterically funny. And I've been familiar with this music as well since the Off-Broadway recording. But what I found here is that songs like Jerry Likes My Corn, which is delivered by Sheila Hancock, has such a sexually provocative element to it, as well as this old lady's buttering his corn cob and while he's in the bed. And it's just amazing. And it's just, there is just so many levels to this music. There is so much that's happening, both in the music and in the drama on the second half, that it's incredibly inventive and incredibly evocative. I also agree that Rachel Ann Raham was formidable and probably, you know, well matched to do Jenna Russell. Rachel Ann Raham plays Little Edie in the first half, while Jenna is playing Big Edie, and she's very well matched to the mother-daughter dynamic that you see playing out when Jenna becomes Little Edie in the second half and is pitted against Sheila Hancock. But her number, Daddy's Girl, which is full of desperation as she's singing to Joe Kennedy, played by Aaron Sidwell, that she's not that hussy, she's not that woman from the wrong side of the tracks. It's just full of desperation, just trying to get out of from her mother's clutches. That it's quite an impressive achievement. I think this is definitely a unique musical, and I think that's probably why a lot of the buzz has come by it. I suspect it's not because of the cult following and the campy following that a lot of people who would be familiar with the documentary would know about it. It is actually that it is something different, it is something funny, but it is also something that it has that emotional connection between that mother-daughter relationship. I think I mentioned, you know, it would make the perfect Mother's Day present if it was playing through to March somewhere, because I think there's something about this show that resonates for anyone, notwithstanding the glamour, the, you know, the riches to rags story and so forth. It is quite an interesting night out at the theatre, and one you probably won't forget for a long time. I liked it quite a lot, and actually I liked it more thinking about it in the days since seeing it.
Gareth, what did you think about this?
Well, I agree with a lot of what John and Paul have said about this. The first thing I'd say really is I think it's the first or the only musical based on a documentary that I've ever heard of, really, which is quite unusual. And I particularly agree with the point that the first act is too long. What they're trying to do with the first act, because the documentary is really only the second act, it's about the two ladies at home, you know, in their decline, as it were. In order to make it into a musical, what they've done, and probably what they had to do, is they had to give that context. So they did have to look back at their life before they got to this situation. But unfortunately, they take too long to do that, because for me, a prologue would be enough to do that, to have a scene at the beginning. So there's a prologue which is late, and then they go back to this whole act of 30 years before, and then they go back in the second act to the period of the prologue. What I think they should have done was had a prologue that was 1941, that showed them at their heyday, and then moved into the present day, because I don't think the whole of the first act serves that purpose. It's basically overplaying that particular period. And particularly because of this quite cramped set where the parties and all the sort of social events of that period are having to be played out on this very cramped set, which of course wouldn't have happened at the time. So the flaw for me in the piece is that the first act is too long, and it should have just been some sort of prologue or preface. And then I think we could have spent more time understanding about how they got to that situation. Because I think the heart of the piece is the relationship, the mother-daughter relationship. And I'd have liked to explore more that, you know, the psychology of that relationship and how they got that way. I think by having this whole chunk that's earlier on, they're kind of cheating a little bit. They're sort of cheating the heart of the play, and we're not, you know, we're not getting enough of that. So as a musical, I think that's its flaw. It's not well structured as a musical. I quite like the score, although, you know, it didn't blow me away, but I quite like the score, that it is very well sung and very well played. But the chief reason for seeing it, I think, is that it is a very, very good production, and of course it does have terrific performances. It's Tom Sutherland. We're used to seeing his work now, particularly at Southwark Playhouse, and I think he's done a terrific job on this. And I did like the set. I thought the set did evoke this kind of this 71 recluse period particularly well. And right at the centre of it, you know, you've got two brilliant performances. It's just hard to imagine better casting than Jenna Russell and Sheila Hancock, to be frank. You know, I think they must have been whooping with joy when they actually managed to secure the both of them. Jenna Russell, she sort of got this incredible combination of pathos and tragic comedy and quirkiness. And I think she's done some amazing work, but it's a career highlight for me. And Hancock has just got great stage presence and great audience engagement. And you get the best of that in this small space, of course. And she just completely inhabits this role of the mother. But, you know, in the smaller part as well, Aaron Sidwell, who has two roles, he plays a young naval man who is apparently Joseph Kennedy, the elder brother of the president, and then later plays a teenager who kind of befriends the ladies. And I thought he was excellent in both of those roles, as indeed he was in American Idiot late last year. The girl who plays the young Rachel Ann Raham, who plays Little Edie earlier than Jenna Russell, if you see what I mean, I thought was also very good, and she had a particularly nice voice. And then you got great support from people like Billy Boyle, you know, veterans like Billy Boyle, who's both, well, who's the dad and the granddad, and Jeremy Leggett, who's, they have a kind of an in-house pianist, which is a bizarre idea, in the early period, and Jeremy Leggett plays that role. And then you've got a servant in the first half and the second half, who are two generations of the same family. And Acca Mitchell, I thought, was particularly good in both of those, really. So it was, I mean, I'm very, very glad I went to see it. I hadn't seen the documentary, so I really had no starting point for it at all, really. But I was particularly pleased to see these great performances and a great production. But I have to say, I think that the show does have flaws. It does appear to be heading for some sort of further life, and it probably deserves that. It's extraordinary now at Southwark Playhouse how these things sell out so, so quickly. And, you know, sometimes you want to go and see something a second time after you've seen a late preview or something, and it's just impossible to get in. But this was another unmissable night at Southwark for me anyway.
Nick, what did you reckon?
Yeah, I think the set alone kind of screams that they want a transfer, because it's almost kind of too big, really, for the space. Certainly from the side seats where I was, you can't really take in the scale of it. So I do suspect that they're aiming for a transfer with this one. And I think it would also do well somewhere else. But it is great to see, particularly this kind of barnstorming production performance by Jenna Russell. And yeah, I think one thing she's really helping the show with is I had moments where, again, I've not seen the documentary either, so maybe it's incredibly accurate, but I did think that it was kind of bordering on making fun of the character's mental illness. And I think her performance is just so good that it doesn't really become that. It's kind of very funny, but subtle enough that it doesn't have that problem, really. And I think probably for the reason that you say, is that a bit too much time is spent on the flashback in the first half, which is, it's not just kind of a reconstruction, it is entirely imagined, because apparently Little Edie did used to tell stories of how she was engaged to Joseph Kennedy, and if he hadn't died in the war, she might have been the First Lady, and apparently he was a very, very vague acquaintance. They didn't really know him that well. She certainly wasn't engaged to him. So the first half is again, kind of sort of her fantasy, really, I suppose you could look at it that way. I think it does mean that the second half doesn't have quite the time to breathe and to kind of, I think sometimes the balance between the tragic and the comic doesn't work as well, possibly because it's spent too much of a story on the flashback. But yeah, there's not a lot I would find to criticize about it. I mean, just, I agree on, you know, the supporting cast. Rachel and Raylan Williams is certainly an interesting new find, and again Aaron Sidwell is so distinct in his two roles. They're so different, and he's so good at both of them. It's very impressive. But I mean, it's Jenna Russell's show for me, and I think that's what everybody's going to remember it for, and deservedly so.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Assetto named London Theatre podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.